This week on Red Dead Radio, we talk Red Dead Redemption 2 news, East Coast Killer, West Coast Killer, an Oregon Trail tangent, education, and much more. It's Jared Petty and Brian Altano. If you support the show on Patreon, we'd really appreciate it. That's reddeadradio.com or patreon.com/JaredPetty. And please subscribe on YouTube, or if you're listening on iTunes or Android, please subscribe, and if you would, leave us a review.
Free horse with every episode. Horse not included with this episode.
Hi, friends. Welcome to Red Dead Radio, the Red Dead Redemption podcast. I'm your host, Jared Petty. And as always, we're going straight to the wild, wild guest.
Hi, I'm the wild, wild guest, Brian Altano. Thanks for having me.
You are wild, wild indeed, Brian Altano. Where do folks know you from?
God, man, I'm on a lot, or not a lot, depending on what you watch. But I'm on IGN, I'm on the Comedy Button, and I'm on a show called Weird Heat. I also have albums out. I do a lot of things, but, you know, tonight I'm doing this.
A modern-day renaissance man,
as it were.
So, Brian, you're here on our Red Dead Redemption show, where each and every week we talk about Red Dead Redemption, Red Dead Redemption 2, our playthrough of the original, our excitement about the upcoming game, as well as discuss the Western films, television programs, comic books, books, music, at all, etc., that permeate our culture and affect everything we do every day. That's right.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really a part of, I think, who we are here in the American idiom.
I think so, too. And it's impossible, no matter where we go as a society, we are drifting closer and closer collectively into sort of larger masses in metropolitan areas. We are also becoming more and more isolated. All of those things cannot move away from the fact that we did originate in the Wild West, and it was all the Wild West at some point. Right?
It was. That is an interesting point. That's something they actually are really good about talking about in Stephen Ives' The West, is that the West kind of changed.
Yeah.
It moved for the folks that called it the West. They also point out that the folks that came up from Mexico, for them it was the North, or for the French Canadian explorers it was the South, and for the folks that lived here it was just home.
Yeah.
But for the folks that finally ended up being the final conquerors of this territory, though so far as we are in history, it was the West.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated with that word because I grew up in New Jersey and then in New York, and the only way to go that wasn't the ocean was west, really. Yeah. I mean, you could go north to Maine, which I didn't want to do, or you could go south to Florida, which I did once a year for Disney World, but everything else was west. Everything.
It's kind of rad. And that's actually something we're going to get to here a little farther along in the show. But first, as always with our wild, wild guest, I have to ask you, what's your history with Red Dead Redemption?
So Red Dead was a game I bought the day it came out. And I think I went in with expectations that it was going to be like Grand Theft Auto, but with horses instead of cars.
Ooh.
And was almost instantly had that train of thought rejected and realized that it's a much more vast, minimalist game.
Can you define succinctly what you think makes each of those games distinctive from one another?
I would say that one of them is cluttered and chaotic, and then one of them is sort of brooding and minimalistic.
Okay.
And I think that I look at it in the same way I think of a lot of things in terms of East Coast and West Coast, you know, music and filmmaking and all these other things. There is an inherent chaos that comes with a game like Grand Theft Auto, you know, anything that takes place in Liberty City. Grand Theft Auto 4 especially, it's New York, right? Mm-hmm. It's packed. Every single moment in New York City is just living, breathing chaos. And then you move out of that and you move into the suburbs and the quiet and to the Midwest and to the heartland. And all of a sudden things become more open, not necessarily less dangerous, mind you.
Uh-huh.
There's a peacefulness there that I think you miss in the moment to moment of being in somewhere like New York City. But when you get out into the wild open, it's sort of a more beautiful use of negative space.
Ooh, I like that.
And I mean that in an artistic sense, not sort of like in a negative sense, because I would say that New York City is full of more negative people.
No, I understand what you mean in an artistic sense. And I like what you said about safety. I think it was Evan McConnell who said during the time of the Western expansion that for a lot of soldiers waiting on the frontier, that the West could be colossally boring until it was lethal.
Right.
And that there was a sense of emptiness, openness, space, and then suddenly tremendous terror or adventure or amazement, and then back to this vast peace and quiet.
We have a terminology for that in like film production called hurry up and wait, which is the two forms of like you're sitting, you're anxious, you're nervous, nothing's happening. And then you're speeding through the next scene or the next take or the next adventure, whatever it is. And I think that's pretty much what a lot of war is like too, I imagine, where it's a lot of just waiting, and then hurry up, wait. It's not all just chaos the entire time.
Periods of interminable boredom broken by sheer terror.
Yes.
I can't remember who said that, but I've read that somewhere as well. You mentioned also that for you, you talked about New York City being so congested. I want to start right here. We were going to talk about this anyway. Let's just jump right into it. You spent most of your life in the East.
Yeah.
And then you moved to the contemporary American West, and you've experienced both of those realities and kind of two big chunks of your life. The first part out there in one of the most congested, famous, big, bright, blazing places on earth, and then coming across the United States to what is a very different culture. On, I think, most continents would be part of another country because of the vastness of the United States.
Yeah, no, completely. And it's interesting because it's like I grew up in basically a small-ish suburban town when I lived in New Jersey, and then New York City was always right there. It was right on, like, I lived off of a highway. Down the highway, you could see the skyline. So, I mean, I grew up looking at that.
Okay.
And so when I moved to New York, I knew I wanted to be there my entire life. I loved it. I fell in love with it. And then I spent basically lived in and around it for a while and thought, this is home. This is it. Wow. I don't need to see anything over there, which is stupid of me because it's also antithetical to the way I function in terms of like food and culture and ideas and traveling. I love to exercise the notion of finding things that I've never found before and eat things I've never eaten before and go to places I've never been, get outside of my comfort zone.
So did it all feel like it was just, did you feel like there was so much diversity and variety crammed into that tiny geographic space that there was nothing to be learned from stepping outside? Was that what
I think that's a big part of it. I mean, I think that's a huge part of it. That's that's one of my like strongest philosophies in terms of the way I interact with the world, is that I learned at a very young age to be understanding and sympathetical and sort of inherently caring about things that weren't just me and people that looked like me, right? Because you get exposure to a lot of different cultures and people and sexualities and ideas and foods and songs and everything. When you live in and around very sort of like culturally congested areas, which I think that you miss out a lot when you move to places where there isn't as much of that. And you have to kind of go out of your way to seek it. And so for me, California was probably a lot of what people from the middle of the country think California is, especially a place like San Francisco. I thought it was, you know, cable cars and Rice-A-Roni. And, you know, I've been on one cable car in 9 years since I moved here. I've never had Rice-A-Roni.
Yeah.
I'm still not sure why that's a thing.
How much soy have you consumed?
Soy?
Yeah.
So that's the thing. I mean, that's the other thing. I hear that a lot. Almost none, because I don't think it tastes great.
Uh-huh.
If there was an excellent way to cook it, I would eat it, but I would probably also have a steak with it. This is a city where you can get one of the best steaks, and they'll tell you the farm that it came from. Like in terms of major metropolitan areas, it's less about fast food, and it's more about really great food and really great culture. And to me, if soy was something you'd be looking for, I don't know. Like, I don't have any friends who are like, I love to eat soy, but I'm also like, I'm a pudgy Italian kid from the East Coast. And
I don't think you're pudgy.
It comes and goes. But the idea of eating pizza without cheese on it is a nightmare to me.
No, no one should do that.
Yeah. That said, I don't think drinking milk inherently makes you a man.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know how to cook your own steak, which a lot of people who say, really?
Is that the test?
I think if you imply that other people eat soy, but you eat your steak well done with ketchup, you're a child.
So. Okay, I'm not touching that one with a 10-foot.
I'll throw it out there. Whatever. No. So that said, like coming to the West Coast, I had a lot of ideas of what that was like, and I didn't know I mean, you hear the West when you grow up on the East Coast and you think cowboy hats. Mm-hmm. And in New York City, nobody wears cowboy hats. You just don't see them. There was a store in New Jersey on the highway near where I lived called Western Boot World.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was fucking amazing. Like, they just straight up sold Western boots that had the spurs and everything on them. And there, like, the idea of even, like, you would have to drive 45 minutes to even go horseback riding where I lived. You know, it's not really, it's not like there were farms everywhere. They're around, you know. New Jersey, actually, when you get into the, like every state, when you drive a little bit past, you know, past the margins, you get to the heartland of it, where you start to see farms and you start to see vast areas and you start to see horses and other things. And so the idea of Western Boot World being a thing was something we didn't understand. And like, we went through the recession in the 2000s.
Okay.
And a lot of stores closed on the highway that I went to, and a lot of bookstores, a lot of CD stores, all these things disappeared.
Tell me Western Boot World endured.
Western Boot World endured. I don't know if they're still there, but as of like 2 years ago, they were still kicking, no pun intended.
Red Dead Radio sponsored you this week by Western
Boot World. Western Boot World. Yeah. Largest advertising budget in the game. And so, you know, it's like you grow up with this weird, I would say, romanticism for the West Coast.
Okay.
And you don't exactly know what it is. And for the West in general, like, I grew up, my dad was a big Mel Brooks fan.
Oh,
so he showed me Blazing Saddles when I was a kid. You know, unbeknownst to me that there's a lot of really offensive shit in that movie, but it's also incredibly funny. And so the idea of the Wild West as a comedic setting was new to me.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah. And so, like, one of my first, like, introductions to comedy was through Mel Brooks. And through him, I learned about Young Frankenstein, obviously, mm-hmm. which is a classic. And Blazing Saddles, which is one of the, you know, I still maintain one of the funniest movies ever made. And the thing that I really liked about it, there's a gag in that movie about Wild West prop towns.
Wild West. I remember that. That's right. Yeah.
Which is basically it's a series of fronts, effectively, which is the kind of building. And this is the thing, you couldn't really trick people with this in New York City. New York City is such a three-dimensional space.
Yeah.
But you could walk down a street in a fake Wild West town and see the bunch of fronts and probably be convinced that it's real.
Because of what? Because the negative space it's set against?
Yes, I think
because
I think so. And I think it's because there's sort of like, there's less depth to the architecture in a Western town. It's, and also a lot of the best action doesn't really happen inside the buildings. Like, when you think about Wild West towns, you think about the saloon.
Yep.
And that's it. No, really, right? And so, it's an interesting setting.
The dance hall and the sheriff's
and
office,
the barn, maybe, and there's the jail, right? Which always has a door.
Jail.
Yeah, and it's always the side of the jail is blown open because the guy's escaped.
And you have the general store where the male lead meets the female lead.
Yeah. And so when you make an open world game, when Rockstar makes an open world game like GTA, you're like, I got to go in every store. And when the doors are closed, you're pissed off because that's antithetical to the way you operate in New York City. In New York City, you can walk down the street and every door is welcoming or weird in a weird way.
Yeah.
Which is odd because it's an angry place that necessarily isn't full of friendship. it's mostly strangers. I always argued that the landscape in New York City is the people, and it changes every single day. It's like randomly generated skylines full of people.
Well, I mean, that's very representative in GTA.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do operate on the thesis that I agree with you. There is a tremendous artistic and storytelling distinction between Grand Theft Auto, which is a parodic and satirical franchise, and Red Dead, which has proven to be something very different, that while it contains elements of humor and parody, it is playing it much more straight. It is a game that is largely about immersive storytelling and majesty. And those are not, that's why I, but having said that, I do think that in a way Red Dead 2 is a sequel to GTA 5 as much or more as it is a sequel to Red Dead 1. And what I mean in that is that this is them taking their next step in open world gaming and defining that genre, which is something Rockstar does pretty well.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's inherently when you're playing something like GTA, you're effectively a menace.
Yeah.
Like, you're chaotic evil and you are out there to combine all the living, breathing, passive elements of the city that you're in into one massive destruction. I mean, there are people that create 50 car pileups in that game. They take civilians walking down the street and they blow them to smithereens or shoot them into space, whatever you can
do. And it's fun.
And it's fun. And I think inherently with Red Dead, there's more of a respect for the environment, and the backdrop that plays out beneath and around you is something a little bit more beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I mean, yes, you are a menace to the animals in that game. You hunt and kill, but there's almost a purpose to it because you take those things and you sell them. When you murder a guy in GTA, you don't drag his corpse to the store and make $5 and get a bigger wallet.
No.
But that's the thing you can kind of do in Red Dead when you kill a bunch of animals.
You can actually take them back and do this. I like the point you're making here. Actually, we're going to go what you said about that visual distinctiveness and cultural distinctiveness. And we come back for the next segment. We're going to talk more about that because it's about time for our shootout, which is our Red Dead Redemption 2 news, and also a little on the trail. We'll be right back. And we're back. Now, before we start with shootout, just a quick note about On the Trail, which is our weekly playthrough of Red Dead 1. Brian, I'm playing back through the first Red Dead Redemption for the first time in a long time right now. Which is fun.
Yeah, no, for sure.
It's redonkulous fun.
I mean, there was a reason people keep asking for that game to be ported to everything. Yeah. People don't really do that with games that aren't good. Like, that's a classic.
It's a superb video game, and it really does hold up going back to it. I'm playing it on regular Xbox One. I hear the 1X version is beautiful, but I don't have a 1X, so I haven't gotten to do that yet. But I find it, it's already a really pretty game, frankly, in its own right, despite its age. But folks have been wanting to play along. And last week, Greg was kind of like, hey, so, you know, what are you going to tell folks that want to play along? Like, well, it's Red Dead, so I just like to wander around and do stuff. But as much as I love that, mm-hmm. I realized afterward, that's not really fair to our audience who wants to keep up.
Yeah.
So I'm still going to wander around and do stuff and tell stories as we come to that. But this week, rather than give a long narrative about my adventures this week, I'm going to save that for next. I'm just going to tell you that if you want to play along on the main quest, I'm going to play up through the quest called A Tempest Looms, which is about the ninth or so main quest in the walkthrough. So if you're interested in playing through, I'm using IGN's walkthrough. It has if you scroll down past the missions listed by character, you'll find a consecutive order walkthrough for the main missions. I'm going through A Tempest Looms for next week. If you want to play along, we'll be talking through up through that area, plus whatever side quests and weird, wonderful environmental stuff, which, let's be honest, is really the heart of Red Dead.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm going to play through. You going to play through it before 2 comes out?
I was thinking about it. I think I will jump back in at least for a little bit. I don't know if I'll finish it.
Yeah.
But it'll be good to sort of get – what I like to do with games like that is I get re-sort of acclimated with mm-hmm. everything just so when the new one comes out, I can be like, oh, my God, that's better, that's better, that's better. Because I know that's the way it's going to work. Rockstar is really phenomenal at sort of taking their little microclimates of systems mm-hmm. and like kind of incrementally increasing them or just throwing them out the window and vastly overhauling them. So I hope – that's something I'll be able to track between now and launch.
I hope so, too. We talked about this a lot last week, but it seems like the creative direction for the game, based on the preview that IGN, where you work, did recently, that's exactly their MO with this game, is refining a formula that they created before and kind of creating a new kind of open-world gameplay that's intrinsically and intuitively immersive, where it's harder to tell where the game ends and the story and the quest lines, you know, where the mechanics and the storyline are blended so much that it's sometimes hard to tell where the quests really are.
Which is really smart, because I mean, I think that a lot of open world games suffer from that issue where they have to meet this marriage of the chaos of the open world and the constant reminder that there's something important going on. Or there's a story that needs to keep happening.
Yeah.
A game like Far Cry 5, you know, shoots you with a dart and drags you into the story zone.
Yeah.
Right in the middle of you hunting for pelts to sell.
And Far Cry has the luxury of being a game that's designed to be kind of wacky, mm-hmm. whereupon Red Dead is not about wacky.
No, not necessarily. I mean, it can be.
Yeah.
When the last Red Dead game came out, I had a friend that came over. I was one of the only people in San Francisco that had laundry in my apartment unit.
Oh.
Which some of you who live outside of a major city are probably laughing at that because that's probably totally normal for you.
Oh, no.
But for us in major cities, it's next to impossible. And so I had a washer dryer in my unit mm-hmm. and my friend would come over and it took me a minute to realize if he was my friend or not because I thought he was just using the laundry.
Yeah. Like the kid that he has a friend who they just stay their friends so they can play their Nintendo games.
Yes.
Like that kid.
Yeah. Which I was that kid.
Okay.
My friend Tony would come over and he would do laundry. And while we were doing, he was one of those guys that was like kind of a lapsed gamer. Uh-huh. And he would be like, "Do you have any games I can play?" And I was like, "Yeah, I got this Red Dead game." And he's like, "What's it about?" And I'm like, "Oh, it's like you're a cowboy." And he's like, "Oh, awesome. I'll fire it up." And so he would play it, and I'd be in the other room playing my 3DS or playing something on the other TV or something like that. And I would go out for a few hours, you know, come back, whatever it was. And he would just do laundry, play Red Dead, and I'd come home and he'd be like, "Hey, I made you like $10,000." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And he was like, I would just go hunting. That's all I do in Red Dead. So he would go out on the horse, get all the guns, hunt all day. He basically treated it like open world buck hunter.
And he was just having fun.
And yeah. And he would just come back to me and he'd be like, "I got you all the best guns. I bought you all the best stuff in the game." And I would
okay.
go, yeah, it was like, it's really funny because like Ryan Scott, my co-host in the Comedy Button,
yeah,
told me a story growing up about how his mom used to play Zelda for him while he was at school, and she would just get him rupees all day.
Oh,
and he'd
wow.
come home and she'd be like, "I got you all the rupees," which is weird because that game has a cap on rupees.
255, but yeah. It does take a while to get 255.
That's
unless
true.
You know where they're hidden.
Oh, I know where they're hidden.
Yeah, so do I. We know this. We know where to get those.
There are many things I do not know or understand in this world, but I know where those fucking rupees are.
Don't even walk into Labyrinth 1 without the blue ring and the white
Seriously.
Sword. Yeah,
yeah,
no
and
reason.
Like six
to.
Hearts.
Yeah,
come on.
Exactly.
Don't even.
You don't want to do those things.
Exactly.
There we go. That's another podcast.
Another
for another
podcast
day.
Entirely. But no, he treated it like that, and it was funny. So I almost played. It was like playing that game with the Game Shark,
yeah.
or Game Genie, because I would come home and I'd be like, "You. I can't be mad at you."
Except it was a grown man neighbor.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Pretty spectacular that you had a personal hunter. It's like having a personal shopper for Red Dead.
I know. It was really great until like my electric bill came every month.
Oh, and then it wasn't so good.
Yeah. Not from the Red Dead, mostly
the
laundry.
Spectacular. Everybody has one of the reasons I started this show, like, why would you start a show about one game? Everybody has a Red Dead story like that. Greg told an amazing one last week about something that just happened in his world, in his game, that probably didn't happen to hardly anybody else that ever played because of those weird... And because it's a storytelling game, some of them are about the metatextual narrative of what happened with us and friends. Even though it's single player, or most of it's single player, we end up talking about it, our social experiences with other people, because it's kind of built that way. You were sort of playing Red Dead like a bunch of kids sort of played the Oregon Trail in a classroom.
Oh, God,
day,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that like, that's what's so special about these games is they have that water cooler conversation thing, right? Where people go in and they go like, "This is what happened to me last night."
Mm-hmm.
And it's completely different than what happened to you. And everyone has their own sort of story. And it's very rarely the story that the game is trying to tell you.
Yeah, well,
you know?
And I think they understand that. I think that they just lean into that, and that's part of how they make that magic work, I'm not sure. So jumping into Shootout for a second, which is Red Dead news. We had so much news from the big IGN breakout last week that we decided to break it into two parts.
Yeah, for sure.
So we're going to cover a little more of that. Last week we talked a lot about the gameplay, thematic stuff. But this week I want to touch for a second on... the gang, the fact that Dutch's gang was revealed, or a lot of those members. And we don't know that much about many of them, but we did learn that you're going to be a part of all of their lives, and they have like camp jobs that they do. And some of these are returning faces. We saw John, obviously, and we see a couple of other people that you'll recognize from games you played before. I was not surprised to see Uncle pop up there, for example. But we also have some new faces. Sadie popped out at me immediately because I had thought I'd spotted in the original Red Dead teaser female clothing on one of the riders. And
right.
I was pretty excited. We did a rewind theater when I still worked here.
Yep.
I was like, "Yay, Sadie's there." I was right. But Arthur, our main protagonist. And I wondered, have you read much about Arthur yet?
No.
Okay.
School me.
Okay, so I don't want to talk it to death, so I'll be real quick. The game does appear to center, or even though it's about a whole gang of characters, and there's a lot of them. There are a lot of people in this encampment. But I get the impression that they are leaning all in on him being the face of the game, and that this is, despite the fact that it's an open world RPG, going to have that kind of JRPG vibe of this is his story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you play an old JRPG... it differed from old Western RPGs in that JRPGs are largely about character. You know, you play as Cloud Strife. You don't play as generic fighter man.
Right.
Whereupon, if you're playing like Ultima or Wizardry or something, you were generic fighter man.
Yeah. Soldier.
Yeah. Soldier. Lone traveler or something. Arthur is Arthur. He has a personality. The personality they presented for him is that he is strong, assertive, charismatic, thoughtful. He appears to be a really smart dude. That's something they seem to have leaned into with him. He's right. Dutch's right-hand man. He doesn't run the gang, but he's the guy that gets things done. And he's kind of the sergeant major of the unit. And that while you have great franchise over how you play him, there is the constant ability to make dynamic choices. Have you seen this at all?
Yes.
Okay, so you're going to be able to go in, and unlike the old game where it was kind of binary, it's going to be contextual. You're not always, again, this is based on what I've read, you're not always going to be able to be like, well, here's the good choice and here's the bad choice.
So when you asked me and I hesitated, it's because this scares me a little bit.
Okay.
Rockstar has a tremendous ability to make me feel guilty for a lot of things. And I have remorse for decisions I made with friends and family in GTA 4.
Mm-hmm.
Like in terms of the way those relationships unfolded, where your friends or your cousin would call you to hang out and you'd bail on him, and eventually he'd stop calling you or he'd call you less.
Yeah.
And that is honestly one of the most realistic depictions of friendships that a video game has ever handled before. Non-realistic was the time I took a girl on a date in a helicopter, crashed her into a skyscraper, jumped out, and she called me from the hospital like 2 days later asking me if I wanted to date her again. But you gotta love Rockstar. No, I love that. But I have remorse and regret for like decisions in the way I've handled that. And so the sort of like the gangs and the encampments and the way you interact with people and the goods and bad choices, this shit keeps me up at night, man. Mm-hmm. Like making the wrong decision with somebody, like the way even like the Telltale games would always handle it, the blah, blah, blah. We'll remember that.
Yeah.
You know, that is a haunting sentiment.
Oh yeah. Will like, any of us ever forget Carly will remember that?
No, I mean, and it sticks with you. And so that happening on a moment to moment, as somebody who bumbles through a lot of life and says a lot of things he shouldn't say and accidentally pisses off a lot of people and has a big stupid mouth, that scares me because I feel like I'm going to make a lot of incorrect decisions or I'm going to send people down the wrong path and I'm going to burn bridges and hurt friendships and fuck things up.
Well, I think that makes the game more compelling. I
think
and that's what I'm excited about. But it also frightens me. I wonder about, so they did a good job, I thought, in the first Red Dead, where the systems were a little more on the surface in what's probably going to be a less sophisticated approach. That was their first pass. They did a good job of making John, I mean, I think most people like John.
Yeah.
John's likable. Do you agree?
Yes.
Yet at the same time, you can choose to cold-bloodedly murder people, or you can choose to talk your way out of things. You can approach things a lot of different ways. In this one, they're going to lean even more into the options being contextual based on time of day, your previous history with this person, where they're coming from, where they're going, what's happened, whether or not they're hungry. So my question for you on that is, we have a distinctive personality in Arthur, but your Arthur's not going to be exactly my Arthur.
I know.
What do you think the key to pulling that off is?
Oh, man. Like, how do they develop that?
What would that look like ideally for you?
I mean, you mentioned the Oregon Trail, right?
Yeah.
Which is, I think, one of the first real games to do that, in that you and I would have vastly different adventures setting down the same road.
That's true, because you're going to the same town, same stop, same forts.
Yep. But you picked, you know, a dentist, and I picked a lawyer, and, you know, I lost two wheels, you lost three. We all drown at the same time, but there it is.
I am going to write a book about this before I die. The Oregon Trail, I believe, is the most subversive video game ever made.
Yes.
It is a game designed for, it's particularly the 1985 version, is a game designed for children to get away with stuff.
Yeah.
It is a game where you can put your friends in a wagon and murder them.
The very concept of that being in the back pocket of every computer that was in every classroom in my initial schooling and in my first through fifth grade, you know, my earliest years, the first time I ever thought that you could even bring video games into school or into work, or that there was even a word for that. And they, you know, they like loosely masked it as edutainment. That is the first Red Dead game I ever played. Right.
I mean,
it had hunting. When you hunted too much, there were no more of that animal. You could effectively overhunt. It had character deaths, you know, it had cowboy hats and caulking the wagon across. Like, that was basically, there were horses. That was the first time I ever played a Western.
Yeah, you were a child gunning down buffalo.
Yeah.
dying. You could die.
You could die.
And not only could you die, but you could choose to murder your party if you wanted. Then you could leave an obscene message for whoever came, because the disc was shared in your classroom for years.
Yep.
Because schools didn't have any money.
Mm-hmm.
And so 3 years later, some kid would come along, find your tombstone, and see the nasty message you left about your teacher.
Yeah.
They would be in the same classroom with the same teacher and be like,
if you wanted to piss off a number of strangers at school, you could either write something horrible on the bathroom wall or leave it in Oregon Trail.
Yeah, that I am. I mean, I've already written part of it.
Yeah,
but I am going to finish this book.
That is effectively the first Wild West game I ever played.
Okay, right? So how do we take that and is it that same idea that Arthur is kind of the trail and that the choices you make are going to determine what that feels like? As we're talking about merging a character.
I think so. And I think it's something a lot of games have experimented with, but, Rockstar has the sort of, the comfort / audacity to take 5-6 years between titles and really focus on making them special. Whereas everybody else has to put out a new game every year. And I find that business model fascinating, and I'm sure everyone watching the MPD does, because for every year we get an Assassin's Creed and, you know, it's diminishing returns for a lot of them, and they have to stop the franchise and reboot the franchise. Rockstar quietly sits back and they go, well, no, we're going to take this year off. And for everyone in the hubbub of E3, Rockstar sits back and goes, we're not going to be there. We don't need to do that. And then they quietly put out a game. They put out a couple screenshots here and there. They build up this huge tease. The fact that you can document the fact that a year ago, 2 years ago, when you worked here, you were doing Rewind Theaters on teaser trailers. And the fact that we're now finally really talking about this game, which I fully won't believe will be released until it's in my hands and I'm playing it. Because they have a tendency to take their time, and they should.
And they should.
Because if you look at the sales, it's working. I know that they will take a system that we all understand, from Oregon Trail to the Tamagotchi to Clementine to every character that we've helped shape the narrative of individually in video games, and they will knock it out of the fucking park, and they'll make something special. And it's going to be scary, because I'm going to be envious of yours, and you'll be envious of mine. Yours. And
but that's part of the joy, is that we will compare those notes.
Yes.
And that we may come to the same final cutscene for all I know, but the paths we took to get to it will be vastly different. And that, I love that. Maybe we won't come to the same.
You talk to parents, you talk to pet owners, and they're like, oh, my dog really loves it when you do this. And they go, oh, my dog hates when you, my dog's an asshole. Or my cat's a real piece of shit. My cat's the friendliest person in the world. You can walk it on a leash, you know?
Yeah.
Stuff like that. The friendliest person in the world. That's what I just said.
Oh, goodness. Will it surpass Pokemon Go as the world's greatest open world game?
We'll see. I mean, it's interesting, because there's I'm really interested in the way Rockstar does their business, because when they started open world games, they were one of the only open world games, and then everyone came in to make an open world game. And in terms of making open world games like GTA, there was a minute there where everyone tried, and then they just stopped.
Yep.
And in the years where Rockstar wasn't making a GTA, which were many of them, where they were still on the top three best-selling games of the year, other companies tried to make open-world games that were based in cities. And then we moved into more open areas. You look at games like Far Cry, Horizon, Breath of the Wild. These are open-world games that share some tendencies with Red Dead, I would say. You know, they have hunting, they have gathering, they have beautiful, vast, minimalistic vistas and stuff like that. Rockstar comes back every single time, and they go, this is how it's done.
Yeah, I'm sure there's others, and somebody's going to yell at me in the comments and remind me I forgot it. But outside of Bethesda, I can't think of another company that was contemporaneous with Rockstar that was doing open worlds the way they did.
Yeah.
And Bethesda's approach was different, but it was a different kind of high-quality approach.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, those two effectively, I think, kind of co-invented the popular version of that genre we have today. There were definitely open world games before that. Someday we're going to have the Sid Meier's Pirate Cast and talk about how much all open world games owe to that. So we lost power there for a while, but we're back. And it's probably for the best that we did, because we were going a little long. And there's actually even more news. So once again, we're going to save that news for next week, because that breakout story, well, there's just a lot in it. A
lot to unpack.
There is a lot, as they say. But we also on our show like to talk about Western film, Western television, all kinds of Western-influenced art that made its way into Red Dead, or that Red Dead reminds us of. And I brought you on here today specifically to talk about a contemporary artistic issue related to East and West.
Right.
Something you know a lot about that I know nothing about. So this is going to be entirely on you.
Sure.
But my friend, I want you to talk about the American Eastern versus Western musical dichotomy that exists, particularly in the world of hip hop.
Got it.
Something you know a lot about. And I really want you to talk first about what that is and how it came to be and why it's a geographic issue. And second, it just in general, if you could just swing that back around to music and regional music in a way to help us understand kind of what's going on in Red Dead there.
Sure. I think it's so cool that you can't, if you look at like Rockstar's two biggest franchises, you have Red Dead and you have Grand Theft Auto.
Uh-huh.
And Grand Theft Auto is East Coast hip hop.
Okay.
It's taken place in the West Coast. It's gone to LA. It's gone to Miami and stuff like that. That is a game. GTA is effectively a game that kind of began as we know it in a fake version of New York City.
Okay.
Right? And GTA, they Rockstar reached out to like local hip hop celebrities and hip hop DJs and stuff like that. When you drive around in GTA, you're listening to rap.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part,
a lot of the time.
Right? That is the culture. That is a lot of what feeds into that world comes from that. And then Red Dead, I think, really leans obviously much more into the sort of more guitar twangy, laid back, low key, minimalist music,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of the West Coast hip hop. And to me, growing up in the East Coast, I grew up listening to New York City hip hop.
Yeah,
because you have a regional bias, and also there's a territorial aspect to that.
Expound, if you don't mind.
Well, hip hop is one of the few genres where people will argue that the music coming from the location that they're in is better than it is somewhere else.
Like I don't want to trivialize this, but like in a sports team kind of way?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, that's a good way of putting it.
All right.
Hip hop definitely has there's a regional bias to hip hop.
Okay.
And for a very long time, that was an easy contest because New York always won. Always. Oh. And then little by little, the world learned, and specifically other places in the country, learned how to make really good hip hop, and we started seeing stuff coming out of the West. We saw Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg put out The Chronic, which is the first West Coast hip hop album that really anyone on the East Coast fucked with, as they say.
Okay. What do you mean by that?
So basically, in New York City, if you lived on the East Coast, you listened to New York City hip hop,
okay,
and you were all set.
And you were there around kind of that local scene while it was going on,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and I had everything I needed. Everything was right there.
Yeah.
You know, I had my Jay-Z's, I had my Nas's. Going back to Eric B. and Rakim, even the original sort of hip-hop movies took place on the East Coast, like stuff like Style Wars and Wild Style and Beach Street. Those were all, they were about the graffiti movement. They were about the breakdancing movement. They were about rapping. They were about all that was happening right there.
Okay.
Spray canning on the trains, all that kind of stuff. Little by little, we started hearing about the stuff that we didn't have on the East Coast, which was really big, long cars that would bounce and people smoking a lot of weed and a lot of like being laid back and people having like do-rags wrapped around their heads and stuff like that. And we didn't really understand that on the East Coast because a lot of people in New York City didn't really have cars.
Were you not laid back with your mind on your money and your money on your mind?
Eventually I was.
Okay.
It took a while.
All right. I was wondering about that.
But Dr. Dre's The Chronic was the first West Coast hip hop album that I think really infected the entire world in a good mm-hmm. way. But to me, I grew up listening to a lot of independent music and a lot of independent hip hop. And in New York City, that meant a lot of smaller groups. You had guys like, you would listen to people like MF Doom and Company Flow. But then you would start listening to other people out on the West Coast. And there was a label called Stone's Throw.
Okay.
And they put out acts like Madlib and Peanut Butter Wolf and all these funny names. Yeah, it's a great name. And so listening to their music was a lot like the way you would describe GTA versus Red Dead. New York City hip hop and hip hop production in New York City was dense, urgent, cluttered, chaotic, threatening. And then you would go out to the West Coast and you would hear things that were more laid back.
Why do you think the West Coast was more laid back? What caused it? What was the genesis of that?
I think it's just slower. It's more chilled out. It's
life.
Less,
you mean
or? Life? Okay. Life on the West Coast in general is slower.
Okay.
Than it is in New York City. New York City, there's a constant urgency. If you are 5 minutes late to a meeting in New York City, you can get fired.
Uh-huh.
On the West Coast, it rolls right off of you. West Coast legalized weed earlier, or at least decriminalized it earlier. In New York City, that was still very much a police state for anything like that. I feel like a lot of my success on the West Coast has been because I brought my psychotic East Coast tendencies out across the country. And that sort of like nonstop flurry of workaholic urgency has carried over. So where people will go like, hey man, like, what should we do today? I'm already like three steps ahead. I'm like, we're doing this, and people are like, slow the fuck down.
Okay, you got to chill a little bit.
Chill out, slow down.
I've noticed a lot of that since I moved out here. Certainly, man, people flake here like nowhere I've ever been.
Yeah,
I grew up out east. People say they're going to be someplace. Generally speaking, they're going to be there. You make the plan, you show up. Here, someone might show up at some point and you might get a text.
Right. And to add to that, like I said, in comparing Red Dead and GTA, just because one place is more cluttered and urgent doesn't make it more dangerous and doesn't make the laid back West Coast less dangerous, because a lot of the hip hop that was coming out was equally violent. It was just kind of chilled out and violent, which is somehow scarier.
What's an example of a chilled out violent track?
Snoop Dogg.
Okay.
I mean, Snoop Dogg being like, murder was the case that they gave me. Like, he's very nonchalantly explaining the actual charges he got in killing someone, you know? And in on the East Coast, you would hear a lot of gunshots. You would hear a lot of police sirens made it into music and stuff like that. The urgency of using breakbeats as a backbone for New York City hip hop meant that they would take old funk and they would take old jazz and they would isolate a small element of that where there was a drum breakdown or a bass line, usually something kind of funky, and they would add like very cluttered drums and noises and horn stabs to it, and they'd rap over it very quickly, and they'd, you know, talk about killing people and stuff like that. And you'd come out to the West Coast and they were sampling George Clinton, you know, they were sampling P-Funk, and like, not you couldn't have the early Dr. Dre, the early Snoop Dogg, the early NWA without P-Funk, right? Without Parliament and Funkadelic making all these music that was just like very laid back, very stonery, very lots of kind of funky synths and stuff like that, and a lot of like twangy kind of guitars. And so a lot of West Coast hip hop for a very long time was more laid back, more sort of had more guitar influenced, more Parliament Funkadelic influenced. And so you would listen to it and you'd be like, this is really chilled out. But you would listen to the message in it and you'd be like, oh, but they're still killing people.
So what's the state today? Between the two?
I think in the same sort of, you know, cultural melting pot where almost everything else is, right? Where I've talked specifically about two coasts in hip hop. It would be a crime for me not to bring up the South, which is where a lot of the urgency of New York City hip hop met with the laid back ideology of West Coast hip hop. Yeah. And they threw in their double timed hi-hats, which is that, you know, you hear all that shit. And I love all that, right? And so all of that meshed together. And for a while there, you know, the South was winning, and then the West was winning, and the East was winning, and all this stuff like that. Now I think so much of it just folds together to the point where you hear, you know, you could hear someone like Taylor Swift singing over a song that has like New York City drums, but an Atlanta hi-hat, and then like a West Coast guitar underneath it. So it's all there.
I love the comparison you draw between Liberty City and Red Dead.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes perfect sense. And I'm so glad we had John here to talk about that, because I really do think that's extraordinarily insightful and thematically congruent with what they're trying to do with both these games. I really appreciate that. Also, you, a composer of music, you wrote the theme for the show.
I did, yeah. That's the fastest way to get a guest spot, I guess.
Oh, it's the right thing. No, you'd have been here anyway, but definitely it helps. It doesn't hurt at all.
Yeah.
You wrote the theme. What were your influences in what you did musically for this thing?
Well, you shot me a text that was sort of like, hey, I want something that's sort of like twangy and guitar-y. And I believe you mentioned a couple of different sort of influences that.
Yeah.
Do you remember which ones?
I talked about Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, of course.
Yeah.
I talked about a couple other things, this and over. Yeah. But when it came to musically, what pulled you in? Like, where did you go?
So I immediately went, I use a lot of guitar work in my music.
Yeah.
And I work with an incredibly, exceptionally talented guitarist named Thomas Rakowitz a lot. He's fantastic. He's put out his own music, lots and lots of albums. He's played on a bunch of my stuff and hopefully more very soon. And so when I first started working with him, I had actually bought a guitar the day before, and I was going to I was going to play again. I actually played guitar when I was like 12 or 13. I took lessons for like 5 years.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Never learned notes, just tablature.
Yeah.
And so guitar has always been part of my music. It's something I really appreciate. And so I immediately went in with that influence and used a lot of guitar heavy synths. And I felt like the drums had to sort of be plodding and sort of a little softer than something crunchier and grimier you would get in my usual kind of sci-fi dystopian production.
Okay.
That said, I did still bring in some modern synths and stuff like that. And yeah. I had a guy when we published the song, he was like, you know, the synths don't really fit in with the theme of the music here. And I was like, well, yeah, I mean, but neither does like 4K HDR and cloud saves. And,
I remember reading that comment.
Yeah, at some point you have to take what was originally this fully focused Western game and realize that it will also have fast travel.
Well, if we never did that, we never have Star Wars.
Exactly.
And sooner or later, we're going to get there. But Star Wars and Firefly and, you know.
Yes.
And likewise, how many Westerns, you know, if we didn't have Yojimbo, if we didn't have if we didn't have Seven Samurai,
mm-hmm.
then we wouldn't have Fistful of Dollars.
And no, not even close.
The Magnificent Seven.
Yeah.
You know, these influences cross over and become new things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you did.
Yeah. Really and, rad. You know, it's not so much about the instruments I go to a lot, but it was a lot about the ones that I don't go to when making like a song for a show like this, because I had to pull myself away from using a lot of very synthy stuff, a lot of very quick moving stuff, a lot of, you know, pianos have a certain distinct sound, or there's organs with the Wild West, you know, like pianos have that rusty sound to them, you know, organs have that sort of creepy, echoey, full-bodied sound to them. And guitars have that twang and that echo to them. And all that is very important when creating music for something that is inspired by the West, you know. And
I think
that's obviously, you'll see more of that when the game's out, because they'll dedicate a full soundtrack to that. Okay. There won't be New York City hip-hop DJs yelling over your horse, although
we don't know.
We don't know that. That would be cool to mod in a time machine.
But we suspect.
We suspect.
Well, Brian, thank you for that one. We're headed into our final segment now, so we're going to take a break here, and we'll be right back. All right, my friend, I got this newfangled technology here. We're back, and it's time for Luck of the Draw. Four completely random topics that have nothing to do with the Wild West. One deck of cards. Brian, depending on what you draw, we're going to ask one of these questions. I got four questions picked out here.
Okay.
All right, so just draw the top card or any card you want.
Any card?
Any card.
I'll go with the top card for
all
the
right.
first one.
What's the suit?
It's a Joker.
It's a Joker.
Of course it is.
Of course it's a Joker. That's right. So,
damn it.
Yeah, so... We don't have a Joker category because I forgot to take the Jokers out of the deck.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So why don't we try this again?
I thought that was for me. It's a fucking another Joker.
I was.
Have you shuffled this deck?
I think it's a sign. So dumb.
It's not a Joker anymore. That's
okay.
Good.
What is it? Oh, we got a club?
Yeah.
All right. So we got a club.
Five of clubs.
All right. So the question is, this is from Dave Brander. Oh, he's a friend of Pockets Full of Soup too.
Hey, Dave.
What one piece of entertainment, books, TVs, films, games, etc., should be in a school's curriculum?
Oh, man.
For example, we all studied Shakespeare at school. What's the equivalent?
A thing that should be in a school's curriculum that isn't.
Yeah, a piece of popular entertainment that should be in a school's curriculum. And
man.
He's talking kind of about our world that we walk around here in the realm of geekdom. What should people be playing or watching or reading from this crazy, grotesque geekiverse
mm-hmm.
that makes up our day-to-day lives?
God damn, that's such a tough one.
Isn't that a great question?
That's a fucking great question.
Yeah, I pick these out. I try to get good questions, and Dave's always got some good stuff. He's a thoughtful dude.
God, I'm trying to think of something that's like both simple and accessible, and also kind of all encompassing.
Maybe a good place to turn would be something you're grateful, something that changed your life that you feel like would speak to others. What's that's got that kind of a accessibility.
So this isn't a specific thing or a game or a TV show or something like that, but it is a thing that my school did when I was a kid that I think every school should do.
Okay.
Can I throw that in there?
Please do.
Okay. We had a thing in elementary school called the International Fair. And I think that's something we were able to do because we had an incredibly culturally diverse faculty and staff and student body.
We had one too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what we did was we took the gym, because that's where everything happened when you're, you know, that's,
yeah.
you had gym class in there. you had lunch in there. And then you had assembly in there.
The spring fling.
Yeah, the spring fling was in there.
PTA meeting.
Yeah, and so when you were there for gym, you would be sitting on the crumbs from lunch. And when you were eating lunch, you'd be slipping on the sweat from gym. And then you'd sit in all of it, and you'd watch some guy do 2 hours on, you know, why you shouldn't do heroin.
Yeah.
You know, that was what it was.
American public school.
Yeah. But once a year, we would have a thing called the International Fair, where they would set up sort of tables, picnic tables, around in a giant ring in the room, and then a couple in the middle too. And then each one represented, each station represented a different country, mm-hmm. a different culture, a different place on the map. And so ideally, there would be a representative from each country that was a student you went to school with and their parents.
Okay.
So a bunch of my best friends growing up, one of them was Greek, one of them was Pakistani, one of them was Korean, one was Chinese, ooh. I was Italian, another was black, and we had all of these different cultures who sort of came from all over the place. So like the family from Trinidad would set up shop in one of the desks, and you'd walk by, and it'd almost be like a science fair, mm-hmm. you know, like picture that, where you would walk by and you would be like, okay, there's a map. Where it is on the map. There's some pictures of the country on a poster board, and all of that is fine and it's all well and good. But the most important aspect of this, the most important, is that every single family or mother or father or student also had to create one item of food
right.
from that country.
This is all very yes. familiar.
Yes. And it is, I don't give a shit who you are
yeah.
or where you're from or what you do. Your racism stops at your taste buds.
That
I genuinely believe that.
That is a. Did you make that statement up?
I kind of just did. Yeah.
That's insightful.
Yo, no, because I really think that it's the kind of thing that, like, if you close your eyes, and somebody just hands you a spoon and of delicious food, and you put it in your mouth and you start eating it, and you're just like exploding with, you know, with joy and elation, and your taste buds are flipping out. And then someone says, that was made by someone from Sri Lanka. And you're like, but I hate people from there. And you're like, well, you don't anymore because you know how they cook. And so immediately I was exposed to food from Pakistan, food from India, food from Korea, food from Japan. And I, you know, I will put it this way. Your stomach is a wreck at the end of the day because all of those things should yeah. not come together.
But
yeah, there's a very specific reason why when you go to buffets in Vegas, they're mostly isolated around a country or three, right?
Because otherwise 15. You have a lot of different yeah, spices yeah. and seasoning.
Yeah, and so time. You're in this room and it's this sort of like this incredible flurry of smells and odors and textures and flavors, and you get to smell curry for the first time and Szechuan wow. and marinara and soy and all this stuff.
I
soy
love sauce. The passion with which you're speaking.
Oh my
here.
God, I mean, yeah. And it's just...
Okay, this is a great answer. I love this. I don't think it's an answer to David's question, but I don't care because it's so good.
Well, I think every school needs it. I think every school needs it. And I think even if you don't, and you get into tricky cultural appropriation territory, but even if your school doesn't have a Pakistani mother and a Korean father and an aunt and uncle from Trinidad, I think there should be some way to at least try to attempt to cook foods yeah. from those cultures or figure out a way to respect them or understand them.
Your racism ends at your taste.
And eat that's from them. Yeah. yeah. Eat from different places around the world and you will be more open to loving and understanding them.
That's great.
Except for Rice-A-Roni, which I still don't understand despite it defining the city I live in.
It's the San Francisco treat.
Apparently, I keep hearing that, but I've never seen anyone eat it.
Yeah, I've never seen anyone here eat Rice-A-Roni.
No!
Actually, no, my wife has eaten Rice-A-Roni okay. here. She insisted on doing it
got
after
it.
We moved here. But that was kind of a novelty.
It was kind of a gag gift. Then,
yeah,
right?
exactly. That was what that was. There's some great food in this city.
Yeah.
All right. Now, Pony Express, because every segment has a cute little name.
Okay.
I'd love to do that.
I like that. I like
eventually,
I want
little graphics there. And sound effects for all of these, maybe. But
like a galloping pony. Goes
yes. And then like comes across the bottom of the screen. Kind of like the whammies on, yes. on Pressure Luck. He's just going to like...
I'm totally into that.
Yeah. So if I can just get sound effects and graphics for all of this. We've got some opening graphics in the works right now, and then I'll be able to play more of your song, which I'm excited about.
Excellent.
They should be done very soon.
Yeah, you asked me to make a 30-second song, and I made you a 3-minute one. I don't know how to make
I asked you to make a 10-second song.
I can't do that.
Yeah. I asked for it, and you made a 3-minute
What's that quote about that author wrote about short? He was like, I was going to write a short story, but I didn't have enough time.
That's kind of spectacular.
Something like that.
My favorite of those is James Joyce, who was found weeping at his desk one day by a friend. And his friend says, "Is it the writing?" And Joyce is like, "It's always the writing." And his friend said, "Well, James, how many words have you written?" And he said, 8. And his friend said, "Well, James, for you, that's not a bad day of writing."
Yeah.
And he said, "Yes, but I don't know what order they go in." I love that story. All right. Couple of Red Dead related questions here. This one from Porg. What Easter eggs would you like to see in Red Dead 2? I'd personally like to see an Easter egg for Westworld.
Oh.
I think Jack _P said he'd like to see the Deluxo in a barn, like the DeLorean in Back to the Future Part 3, or maybe in a cave. Which
that's a great idea.
Cool.
I love that. I want to see the glitched out Donkey Woman. I think she should be like in a cage in some town, and everyone should be like, $10 to see the freak, something like that.
Wow. Yeah. That's both horribly and like.
Oh, it's wildly insensitive,
yeah,
but it's also fake.
That's amazing. Oh my gosh.
For those of you that don't remember, the last Red Dead game had a glitch where like donkey faces would appear on some of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like this woman in town that had a donkey head, and it was terrifying, and you could talk to her.
Wow, that's...
So I want to see them address that.
Freaking amazing.
Yep.
What about this one from Michael, who asks, are you excited for more John Marston? We talked about this some last week. John's in the game.
Mm-hmm.
We know that. How do you feel about that?
I'll put it this way. For the longest time, I was incredibly hesitant to indulge in any kind of non-essential backstory media for a character I already know the demise of.
Uh-huh.
I would say like prequel type things never really work out for me.
Mm-hmm.
The Star Wars prequels are things that grew on me, but stuff like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre prequels.
The Star Wars prequels grew on you?
Yes.
Get off my show.
Oh, come on.
Get off
no,
my
I mean, there
show.
Are... Please.
It grew on you like a... Oh, no, like a canker.
Do
like
you
a,
100%...
Like a boil.
Do you completely hate every part of every moment of them from top to bottom?
Yeah.
Really?
I really loathe those movies.
Oh, that's unfair. I think there's
I tried liking them. I wanted to like them. I was there opening night for all three of them.
Okay, so this is what you need to get. You need to get the visual dictionaries and the making of art books, and you'll start to appreciate at least the artistry that went into some of the designs that are there.
Oh, Doug Chang's an amazing artist.
Oh, like, absolutely.
I have no problem with that. I'm great with that, and I'm great with...
Clone Wars
did some amazing stuff.
The practical effects in episode one, they built more props and sets for that movie than they did pretty much the other two combined.
Mm-hmm. Wish I could have told the difference.
So. It's hard to tell, but they're there, and you appreciate them.
I just feel like at that point, it's kind of...
Watto.
Like, it's kind of like going through your poop looking for corn. Like, there's just... Anyway.
Usually you can see the corn. By the way, that... This is so gross, but that always reminds me like when you're broke and you buy Hungry Man and the corn gets into the brownie.
Oh,
that always happens, right?
It does.
And then you eat it anyway. It just looks like poop.
The same has occurred to me.
So with John, I was pretty against prequel backstory stuff until I watched Better Call Saul, which is a story that explains the entire backstory of of Saul Goodman,
right? From Breaking Bad,
Jimmy, who I was like, I don't need this show, and then I realized this is incredibly well done.
Yeah,
it's not necessarily that prequel stuff is bad; it's that it's mostly usually bad. But there's a way to do it great, and I trust Rockstar to do this great.
That same here. I don't think this is John's story. I think they've been pretty clear. This is a game about Arthur, and I'm sure they'll have some surprises to pull for us. But I welcome the mode of storytelling. And trust me, they tell a good story. They're good.
Yeah.
That's something they're pretty delightful at. Finally. As always, we end the show with our Red Dead Radio Poker Tournament. Every week we deal a hand of five-card draw to a guest. And then because it's not real poker because you can't actually do anything about it.
I don't know how to play real poker.
You're the second guest in a row. So we've done this twice. You're the second person that doesn't have
to
play
Alana?
Poker. No, Alana, we didn't do this the first week.
Okay.
We did it with Greg last week. Alana's going to get a makeup hand at some point because
because
she wasn't here. Because I hadn't thought of it yet. So your job is to beat Greg. Greg had a pair of nines.
Okay.
So I'm going to deal you five cards.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to tell me, even though you don't know how poker works, that this was a really good idea. I should have checked to see if people knew how to play poker beforehand. You're going to tell me how many cards you want to throw away to get new cards to replace them, and then you're going to...
Can I look at them first?
Yes, you can look at them first.
Okay, so I can look at these.
You look at these. You're trying to make the best... Now, you don't know the rules to poker, but you're trying to make the best poker hand you can.
I think this is a good hand.
Okay, do you want to throw any away? and get new ones?
Yeah, I'll try. Do I? What's? Are you trying to get the lowest amount or the highest amount?
It's poker. I think it's more fun if I don't tell you. What
you're okay. Well, we'll go with golf rules. I want the lowest. I don't want that card anymore.
All right. Okay. So
that's not great.
All right. What's your hand, my friend?
Do you want to see?
I want to see.
I have two twos, an ace, a five, and a jack.
Let's show that to the camera here. Two twos. An ace, a five, and a jack. Do you know what that hand is called?
Shit.
That's called a pair of twos. Okay. Greg Miller had a pair of nines,
okay,
which
so
is
he
higher.
Wins.
So Greg Miller wins. So okay, Greg Miller is still our tournament poker
Excellent.
Champion.
Congrats
right
to Greg. And it makes me feel better that neither of us know how to play this game.
And I'm just going to go ahead. Now that I've just got to do this. I've been thinking about it. We're just going to make this official. I think we need to have a poker night live stream at some point where we teach you guys to play poker.
I feel like if I've gone this far in my life without learning, I'm going to keep going.
Really?
I like these jokers, though. I got a pair of jokers, so to me, I win anything that came after it.
That's kind of great. Yeah. Poker is a delightful game. What I just did with you there isn't really how poker works, but there is no better card game than poker. It's superb.
I disagree. I like the matching card game in Super Mario Brothers 3. I think that's probably the best card game there is.
I think Red Dead Redemption 5 or Texas Hold'em is the best video game.
I actually really like Uno. I'm awesome at it.
You're awesome. Yeah. How can you be awesome at Uno?
You try not to get as mad as everybody else.
So that you remember to say Uno?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what it is?
Yep.
Do you psych out people during Uno? You get them on tilt?
I do what I can to subvert them until I win.
I love you so much.
I love you too.
Thank you for giving up an evening for this. You
of
have,
course.
For those of you watching, there have been just like myriad technical problems tonight, which were all my fault.
Totally fine.
And Brian has waded through all of them for hours. So
it's totally fine. I mean, as long as if this gets published, then that means that we're all good. My theory is that it was the podcast gods steal a show a year.
Okay.
Like they just come in and they're just like, this is ours. Well, this is the sacrifice.
This is the second time this has happened to you too, though. I came in with that one time with a mic and the mic broke. Like
here's the thing. If the microphones weren't here and the cameras weren't here, I would still be doing shit like this with you.
That's
you and
true.
I would still be talking. I think if you took everything away, I would still find an excuse to hang out and talk to you. You're doing my show tomorrow night, so.
Yeah, tomorrow night, Comedy
fingers,
Button.
Comedy Button tomorrow. Fingers crossed that nothing breaks.
And what about Weird Heat? What's coming up soon on Weird Heat?
We are doing an episode on growing up, and then we're trying to do as many episodes as possible before I go have a kid, because I'm going to become a father. But Weird Heat, if you don't know about that, is a show we do twice a month where Max Scoville and I take one word, a concept such as optimism or nostalgia or isolation, and we have just a casual hour-long conversation about that. A lot of that sort of tends to step into, you know, mental health awareness and friendship and mm-hmm. depression, but I think we do it in a way that's approachable and open and honest. And if you don't want to hear my voice anymore, I also make a new song for each episode, so you can just hear that, and they're on Spotify and iTunes.
New
and all
songs,
that stuff.
Original art for each episode. I love it. I watch it. It's good.
Thank
good
you. Stuff. Thank you so much.
It's all filmed in that kind of artsy black and white.
Yeah. We didn't want to color correct, so we just popped that black and white filter on, and it got an A+ in art school.
Well done. Excellent. Thank you so much, friends. As always, you can reach us at mail@reddeadradio.com. That's mail@reddeadradio.com, or at least you can if I can ever log into it. So well, hopefully that will work. Thank you. And Brian,
you.
Anything else you want folks to check
no,
out?
No, that's it. Thanks for supporting Jared, and I'm incredibly excited to play Red Dead.
Bye, friends.
See you soon.